Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the Washington Post reported that senior officials inside the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had banned the agency's policy analysts from using a list of seven words or phrases in official 2019 budget documents. The Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the CDC, has since disputed the essence of that report, saying that there are no banned words or phrases. Coming up, we'll hear more about the litany of semantics changes in science and public health policy under the Trump administration and what it could mean going forward. Joining us now is Washington Post health reporter Lena Sun. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The event you reported on occurred last Thursday at a meeting between CDC policy analysts and senior CDC officials who oversee the budget. What were the analysts told that troubled them?
So this is part of the internal federal budget review process that goes on every year around this time to get ready for the president's budget that is presented to Congress in February. And as part of that, the folks who work on drafting these budget narratives are told or given guidance what to do and when they have to get their drafts in. At this particular meeting, these people who work on drafting these budget documents were told that certain words had been flagged by higher-ups as being problematic, and that those words were vulnerable, entitlement, and diversity, and that there was written guidance because they were coming back in drafts as flagged. Then the senior person also said that there were other words that officials didn't want to put in writing that were also ones that these analysts should avoid. And then she said they were fetus, evidence-based, science-based. And that immediately prompted a discussion because in the wonky world of budget writing, you are limited to the number of characters you can use in your line, you know. Mm-hmm. And evidence-based is much shorter than the alternative that they suggested to the science.
Not to mention that the alternative they suggested in some people's minds means something entirely different. Tell us what the alternatives were for evidence-based and science-based.
It was something like CDC uses science to it bases its work on science and in consideration with community standards and wishes. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. And that is a very long and clunky phrase. And as you said, it suggests different things. In that discussion, then people asked the word transgender also came up. Mm-hmm. And that was, they were also told to avoid using those words. As part of the budget process, and to put in context, every administration has these tweaks. But these people who work on this process felt like this had crossed the line. And the analyst who spoke to me even noted in this person's notebook, these first three words, there was written guidance, and these last four words, there wasn't written guidance, and they were all marked by this person in this person's notebook as forbidden words.
Someone, when I was reading up on the reaction to this, someone said, how do you talk about studying the issues with the Zika virus on developing fetuses without saying or writing the word fetus?
Right. Well, so here is where I think people need to have the understanding of the context. These words were told to the analyst to be avoided in drafting the budget documents, mm-hmm. only in drafting the budget documents. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the CDC is not going to be able to use these words in their research or other published reports as part of the agency. Yesterday, the HHS spokesperson, Matt Lloyd, said, you know, this is budget guidance. It's not official administration policy. So they narrowly defined it.
Right. And I get that completely. What I'm wondering about is why these tweaks now?
That is a good question. And the analysts and officials at another HHS agency were also told to avoid those first three words, diversity, entitlement, and
Vulnerable. That's good.
And that comes, there's an actual guidance document. We've seen the page that says style guide, and it says words to avoid, and it lists these three words, and it says unless they're in a legal citation or they're in a title. So it's very clear to the people who are writing these things that, you know what, not to use these words. Why? There is speculation that perhaps couching things in this way will make it more appealing to the congressional folks who have to approve funds for the budget. But we spoke to Tom Cole on the House, who was in charge of this on the House side, mm-hmm. and that's what he speculated. But, you know, it's not like we have a different crew of people up on the Hill. It's the same folks who are approving this for the last several years.
Right.
So the budget analysts, they all know this. So it's not clear, and nobody was able to tell us why people would only be speculating, which was to somehow couch this in what they thought would be more acceptable ways. Again, but that's them speculating.
We're talking about tweaking language in the upcoming 2019 budget documents. My guest is Lena Sun. She's a Washington Post health reporter who reported that higher-ups in the Centers for Disease Control told policy analysts who write those budget documents to avoid certain words, some of which were put into print, vulnerable, entitlement, diversity. Others were just verbally mentioned, fetus, evidence-based, science-based, transgender. Lena Sun, what about the word transgender? That's just raised a lot of hackles, and it's not a new thing. You also reported that several key federal agencies have changed policies on how they collect data about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. So when you've seen from that context, what are we talking about here?
Well, I think that there might be different reasons or different explanations for behind each of these words.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when they talked about evidence-based and science-based, the people in the room were told that the CDC folks had searched all their budget documents and found that, like, every budget doc, there were a lot of uses of evidence-based and science-based used so often as to make it meaningless. But on transgender, there's evidence from other agencies where the administration has made information about LGBT activity or information less accessible, and that is more broad, and that's making advocates wonder, like, what is the message you're trying to send here?
Mm-hmm. Can you get responses from Health and Human Services about that? They've also removed information about LGBT Americans from the website at HHS. What have they removed, and how do they explain it?
That is something that they have chosen to address things very, very specifically. And, you know, they say that this information is still available. You just have to search a lot harder to find this information. And I believe that this is, it's, you know, within context, the administration has been making word changes in lots of other different areas as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think every administration wants to have its own mark in this way. But for these particular budget analysts and for the folks at CDC, this information, when it was passed down, really, really hit a nerve because, yes, you can say, okay, it's just budget guidance and it's just to get the folks on the Hill to approve our funds.
Mm-hmm.
But words matter because they also send a broader message about what your priorities are. And maybe this will suggest what the administration will fund or what they won't fund is what these folks are saying.
You've sought comment from the Office of Management and Budget, which has the authority about what is included in the final budget documents. Have they responded yet?
No, they haven't responded. But we found out yesterday that this particular guidance that was distributed to HHS comes from within HHS. That budget document that I referred to, the FY 2019 Congressional Justification Instructions, is a very lengthy document, and I believe on page 16 is where the style guide is on words to avoid. That is a HHS guidance document, which the spokesperson said yesterday, this is not official administration policy. And I think you've seen CDC officials, CDC Director Brenda Fitzgerald, went to great lengths to say that the agency is going to base everything on science like it always has. I think that's to address the fear that folks, I think, might legitimately feel that, oh, well, if you're banning this, if you're preventing people from using these words in the budget documents, what does it mean about your other things? And they're saying, no, it's only in these things, and we will still follow the science.
Well, I wonder how members of Congress who review these budget documents to make their decisions about whether to vote for it or not, how they feel about this kind of manipulation. But you're saying that there's tweaking with every administration.
Yes, there's tweaking within every administration. I think what I'm sensing here is with this administration that somehow, at least the folks that I talk to, feel that it's crossed the line. Tom Cole, who chairs the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Labor, Health, and Human Services, told us Monday that he was quote-unquote alarmed by these reports. And he speculated that, you know, what this is more silly than sinister, and that staffers may have crafted this language to court favor with the lawmakers. And it's more of a bureaucracy trying to react to what they think the new administration wants to hear. But, you know, Democrats are rightly concerned, and they want to make sure they've asked for the HHS acting secretary to make sure that to ask about how and why this is being implemented, because it is sending a signal, or it has the potential to send a signal, that somehow, you know, scientific advancement at the agency is being frozen or ideology is taking precedence over science.
What sort of response have you heard from the scientific community?
Oh, my God, that has just been
crazy.
Overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, the national, every single public health association, the National Academy of Sciences, schools of public health dean of the association that represents the schools of public health, all have written about their concern about what this means and wanting to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, in the interest of transparency, if HHS feels like this is just budget guidance and it's not official administration policy, then perhaps they should make this document public so people can read what it says themselves.
It's not a public document.
Well, we haven't been able to get it.
Okay.
We have seen it, but we don't. They are not making it available.
Lena Sun, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lena Sun, Washington Post health reporter. We'll have a link to her stories about efforts by the federal agency, Health and Human Services, to change wording in 2019 budget documents. Certain words have been flagged: vulnerable, entitlement, diversity. Other words, fetus, evidence-based, or phrases evidence-based and science-based, and also transgender have been the writers, the analysts have been cautioned not to use them or to avoid them. We'll continue our conversation about what this means coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, the Washington Post reported that senior officials inside the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have banned the agency's policy analysts from using a list of seven words or phrases in the official 2019 budget documents. The Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the CDC, has since disputed the essence of the report, saying that there are no banned words or phrases. We just heard from the Washington Post reporter that broke the story. She stands by it. The seven words and phrases are vulnerable, entitlement, diversity, transgender, fetus, evidence-based, and science-based. Health and Human Services said officials were not available to join the conversation today. We're going to talk about the significance of such an edict, whether it was in writing, whether it was verbal, whether it was maybe not an edict, whether maybe it was even just a suggestion. Joining us is physicist and former U.S. representative from New Jersey, now CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Rush Holt. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Also with us is Vice President of Health Promotion, Chief Wellness Officer, and Dean of the OSU College of Nursing, Dr. Bernadette Melnick. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
Dr. Melnick, when I saw this story, you were the first person I thought of. You routinely underscore the importance of evidence-based policy. The Post reported that policy analysts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were given alternative phrases. Instead of science-based or evidence-based, the suggested phrase was CDC bases its recommendations on science in consideration with community standards and wishes. Is there a difference for you between evidence-based, science-based, and that phrase?
I think, Anne, for one, whether what was said was accurate or not gives us a fabulous opportunity to bring great visibility to why evidence-based practice, why science-based recommendations are so important for the health of Americans.
But can you say that along with community standards and wishes and have it mean the same thing?
Evidence-based practice is a problem-solving approach to the way we deliver healthcare that integrates the best evidence from well-designed studies and combines them with a clinician's expertise and patients' or communities' preferences. So it's very similar. What they're saying is we should bring in the values of the community along with the best evidence from research to make great decisions about what we do in practice.
A New York Times article on this issue said that a few CDC officials said that the semantic changes were a technique to help secure Republican approval of the 2019 budget. Representative Holt, this is just for budget documents. You're a former representative. Do words really matter in these things?
Well, of course, words matter in budget documents, but words matter in policymaking, in regulations, and in all public thinking, all public decisions. So, I mean, here's a case where whatever is behind this, and we haven't seen the document, it's only verbal accounts from CDC employees who were there. To them, it sounded like censorship, or it sounded like advice that they should use self-censorship. So in either case, it's a bow toward ideology. Rather than evidence. This is what you've been talking about this whole hour, what we've just heard from Dr. Melnick. If you want to have good policies, good regulation, whether this is in public health or healthcare or any other public area, you should start with your best understanding of how things are. In other words, you should ask the very first question and the very last question: what's the evidence? And so this is for whatever's going on here, whether it's the way you communicate with your legislators or the way you communicate with the public or the way you think about things within the office or the laboratory, it's a nod to ideology. Clearly the words transgender, fetus, diversity, entitlement, those are in there not in order to get more precision in your use of language or in your thinking. It is a nod to people who have ideological objections to the use of those words. And, you know, ideology is just pre-baked, cast in concrete opinions. That is not the best way to understand and learn how things actually are. And therefore, that's a bad starting point for policymaking or regulation, whether it's healthcare or public health or anything else.
Dr. Melnick, if you're making a proposal for a grant to study the effect of the Zika virus on the developing fetus, what other word would you use besides fetus?
That is the word that I would use. This would set us back decades if we did not use the word science-based, evidence-based. Right now, we know it takes years. The saying is 17 years to translate findings from research into clinical practice mm-hmm. to improve outcomes. Our National Institute for Evidence-Based Practice here at Ohio State is working with healthcare systems all throughout the United States and globe on how to implement and sustain evidence-based practice. People assume when they come in to a hospital or a healthcare system, they are getting the best evidence-based management. But our research shows differently. We're a long way away from evidence-based practice being in the DNA of every practicing clinician. So we cannot stop educating the public about why evidence-based practice is so important.
It sounds like they're not interested as much in the public, Rush Holt, as they are in the policy, you know, the people who have their hands on the purse strings of the United States government. Are they, when you were in the Congress, was it for three terms?
I was in Congress for 16 years, eight terms.
Okay, so I apologize. Were you sensible to that things were being written to curry, at least maybe when the Democrats were in control? You're a Democrat. But was that obvious?
Well, sure. You know, everybody, when they're preparing their request to Congress for funding from any government agency, they're walking on eggshells, and they, you know, try to win the favor of the appropriators. You can sort of understand how this came about. But whatever the reason, as I said a few moments ago, whether mm-hmm. you're communicating with the public or with the legislators or just with your coworkers within the laboratory or the office, your first question should be, what's the evidence, not what is somebody's ideology that you want to hie to. It's of course the CDC deals with epidemics, and this would be maybe a farce if it didn't come in the midst of what I would call an epidemic. I mean, it's an epidemic of people throughout government and really our culture at large, allowing ideology and wishful thinking and opinion to substitute for evidence in so many public areas, whether it's climate change or GMOs or vaccination of your kids or the economics of tax cuts. People start the conversation and end the conversation with an ideological assertion instead of what is the evidence. And so, this is of great significance. I would say this epidemic, as I call it, is growing in virulence, and it is at the root of many of the things that bother us now about our public issues. Alternate facts and fake news and all of these other things are happening because people let them happen. They are not demanding evidence at every turn.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the news that some senior officials in the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the Centers for Disease Control, told budget policy analysts what kinds of words and phrases to use in their official 2019 budget documents. You just heard from Rush Holt. He's CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, also a former member of Congress and a physicist. Also with us is Dr. Bernadette Melnick. She's Vice President for Health Promotion, the University Chief Wellness Officer, and Dean and Professor in the College of Nursing at OSU. Dr. Melnick, I wanted to ask you about whether these kinds of issues, these kinds of controversies at the federal level, do they send messages to people like you who you're always working on a grant somewhere?
You bet. We have to be careful, though, in terms of what the media can do to help us or to set us back in certain circumstances. Again, I look at this as a grand opportunity to say to people, to say to policymakers, we have a body of strong research that says when people receive evidence-based healthcare, healthcare quality improves, safety improves, population health outcomes improve, and costs decrease. We spent more money on healthcare than any Western world country, but yet our health outcomes rank 37th. And part of that is because evidence-based practice is not still standard of care throughout our entire healthcare system.
And part of that reason is because it takes so long to, as you said, to move from that research to clinical.
The bedside.
The clinic.
The bedside. Absolutely. But we have to skill our clinicians. There is a 7-step process for implementing evidence-based practice. We have wonderful entities like the United States Preventive Services Task Force that put out evidence-based recommendations based on best science, but yet it takes years for providers to often adopt those evidence-based recommendations, because a saying is alive and well, and that's the way we do it here. That's the way the outdated policy says we have to do it. So we have a lot of work to do to consistently sustain this in our healthcare system.
I just want to let listeners know that we did reach out to the CDC and the Federal Health and Human Services for their participation today. We did not receive a response. Semantics surrounding the LGBT community appear prominently in changed policies, not just that we're talking about right now. The HHS, along with justice, education, and housing and urban development, have changed how they collect government information about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. What is the objection that you understand, Rush Holt, as a former member of Congress and as CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science? What kind of impact could that have?
You know, this has a very, I think, insidious and corrosive impact, and I can only repeat myself by saying that, you know, science is a way of asking questions so they can be answered empirically and verifiably. It is so important to think like a scientist. I'm not saying everybody in the country should wear lab coats, but I'm saying on public issues, you should ask that the questions be framed so that evidence can be gathered and examined, and then that evidence can be examined openly and publicly. That's what science is. And so when I say think like a scientist, really all I'm asking is that each of us all the time on public matters, not on matters of aesthetics and personal faith and so forth, but on all public issues, ask, what is the evidence? And, I can't emphasize strongly enough how important this is. It's an American tradition that goes back centuries. We've been a very empirical, experimentally minded country. We used to plan public health programs with our best understanding of how things are, what Dr. Melnick calls evidence-based thinking. We're edging away from that now. There's an erosion in the appreciation of science and an erosion in the traditional, I would say, American reverence for evidence.
The dean of Boston University School of Public Health told the Associated Press that if you cannot use words like transgender and diversity, it's a clear statement that you cannot pay attention to these issues. And again, Dr. Melnick, is there somebody out there somewhere that's thinking, gee, I want to study something about transgender Americans, but I'm not going to get the backing of the United States government? That you can see where, it's written on the wall now, they're not interested. I mean, does it have a chilling effect?
Federal funding has become so incredibly competitive these days. So I think discussions like this might bring concern to researchers. Right now, only about 12 to maybe 15% of grants are getting funded by the National Institutes of Health. Everybody who is competing for grants is well qualified with PhDs. Mm-hmm. What I say all the time, though, when we design studies, we have to develop interventions that are not only great evidence-based interventions, but they're scalable. They're easily scalable to the real world because we want to cut that time gap from the production of research to its implementation in the real world.
Okay. Rush Holt, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for doing this program.
Rush Holt, CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's a former member of Congress and a physicist who served as an assistant director of a national laboratory. We'll continue our conversation with my other guest, Bernadette Melnick. She's chief wellness officer at Ohio State, where she's also dean and professor in the College of Nursing. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, The Washington Post reported that senior officials inside the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had banned the agency's policy analysts from using a list of 7 words or phrases in official 2019 budget documents. The Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the CDC, has since disputed the essence of the report, saying there are no banned words or phrases. Earlier, we heard from Washington Post reporter who broke the story. She stands by it. We also spoke with the CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The 7 words and phrases are vulnerable, entitlement, diversity, transgender, fetus, evidence-based, and science-based. Health and Human Services said officials were not available to join the conversation today. We're talking about the significance of such a series of rulings. Still with us is Vice President for Health Promotion, Dean of the College of Nursing, and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State, Dr. Bernadette Melnick. And joining us now is Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Michael Halpern. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
You've written a lot about how the word ban goes much further than Health and Human Services and the CDC. How so?
It's extremely important for us to put this in a bigger context. This kind of word ban is not happening in a vacuum. A couple of weeks ago, the Environmental Protection Agency said it didn't want advice from scientists who receive grants from the agency to study air or water pollution. And a couple of months ago, the CDC told reporters that they needed to go through the Public Affairs Office even for basic data requests, that scientists at the agency, if they received requests, could not provide even basic information to the public or to reporters without asking for permission first. So when we're looking at access to federal government information and access to federal government scientists, calling out specific words as taboo gives us a lot of concern that the CDC will be less able to protect the public and to protect vulnerable groups and to really address a lot of the public health threats that we face.
You wrote that you wanted to hear the head of CDC deny this directly, and she has. I mean, are you convinced that this has all been misinterpreted yet, as they suggest?
I think it's important to look at the words that she used. She did talk about the fact that there wasn't a so-called ban, and I think that's kind of open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. But we didn't hear her come out and embrace diversity. We didn't hear her come out and say, we are going to continue to do research that supports transgender people. We just heard that the work of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is going to continue to be science-based, which is a good start. But this kind of malaise goes far beyond the CDC director. And so so far, the Health and Human Services Department has been silent. The White House Office of Management and Budget, where we think these kinds of directives came from, has been silent. We need to hear messages from the White House that science is going to be respected, that scientists can do their work honestly and openly, and not really have that fear of censorship. Because if scientists are looking over their shoulder, worried that they might say the wrong word, they're not going to ask the tough questions we need them to ask.
I wanted to go back to the point that the EPA didn't want advice from scientists that receive grants. I'm trying to understand that they ban scientists who receive EPA grants from advising the agency, but states and tribes that receive grants are not banned. You wrote about this. What's the difference?
And there really is no difference. It's a completely arbitrary decision to exclude academics who, at Ohio State and at other universities, who want to volunteer their time and give their expertise to the agency, while preferring advice from states and tribes and industry. There's no similar provision to ban or prevent a scientist that works for an oil company or a chemical company from providing that kind of advice. And it's important to point out that conflict of interest rules already existed at EPA. There were already ways that the agency was weaning out conflicted advice. And so this was just an unnecessary action that prevents the agency from getting advice that it might find inconvenient in the future, because if they can't justify, if they corrupt the federal advisory process, then it's much easier to justify decisions that are not science-based.
I'm going to take a call from Michelle in Lima. Hi, Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Just one comment I had was that the political considerations that we get come down from the president and Congress and the state legislatures and so forth need to be taken into consideration, too. You can't fund every bit of research that there is, and so you're going to be looking at priorities. And sometimes people say, why go to the moon when we can't feed the people here? Kind of using an example.
Uh-huh.
But I hope we're not stepping away from science, but we do have other considerations to look at, too.
Yeah. Thanks, Michelle. That goes to Bernadette Melnick, the whole community values thing that we have to set priorities. We can't pay for everything.
Right. And in terms of research funding, agencies like the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, AHRQ, they do put out priorities, calls for grants in specific areas. Take, for instance, diversity.
Uh-huh.
I mean, at the National Institutes of Health, there is a national institute to address diversity issues and health disparities. And I don't see that going away by any way, shape, or form, because we know that's a huge problem that exists in our country.
But, Michael Halpern, you've written that science agencies are targeted across the board for big budget cuts. What's the source on that? And you know, do you agree with Bernadette Melnick that things like that agency on diversity within the National Institutes of Health isn't going to go anywhere soon?
Yeah, I think that much of the president's budget proposal at agencies like CDC and EPA had deep cuts for the science parts of those agencies, and that really alarmed researchers, because if you don't do the work and you can't collect the data, you're flying blind into policy decisions, and you're not addressing the problems you need to address. I think it is absolutely appropriate for administrations to set priorities in terms of the overall areas they want to put their emphasis, but they shouldn't put constraints on how scientists can approach those priorities or what kind of studies they can look into to address the really tough questions that our society wants to address. And so I think it's really important for researchers at Ohio State and around the country to talk about the impact of their work and to make the case to the American public that free and unfettered scientific research is in everyone's best interest.
I couldn't agree more. You know, decades ago, scientific journals would not want to publish studies that did not have positive outcomes. It is critical. We have an ethical responsibility as scientists to report our findings to the public in all circumstances, but especially those studies that are publicly funded.
I thought you raised an interesting question, and we've kind of been talking about it a bit, Michael Halpern, in one of your recent writings, that you're concerned about self-censoring. The CDC staff canceled a conference on climate change and public health even before the inauguration. Now, I was wondering, what's the evidence that that was related to the changing of the guard in the White House? But furthermore, what about self-censoring?
So I think a lot of federal employees, you know, they want to keep their heads down and they want to do their work and they want to do it with as little controversy as possible. But they're also they generally are watching which way the wind is blowing. And when reports come out that there are words that are banned or that you can't talk about a specific issue, it sends the message that scientists really should be keeping their heads down completely. When scientists who work for NASA or CDC or the Department of Energy fear for their jobs for sharing their expertise openly with the American public, I think we're all worse off for it. And we saw it recently with Joshua Tree National Park out in California, where the head of the park was summoned to Washington, D.C. to meet with Secretary Ryan Zinke, Department of Interior, for a tongue-lashing because the National Park had sent out some tweets about climate change. And that kind of environment does not engender a lot of faith that the administration will accept open and honest science communication.
It's kind of like, Bernadette Melnick, if you had to get permission to come on the show every time I call you and ask you to talk about things like this, isn't it?
Yes, I would say that is comparable. I am currently a member of the National Academy of Medicine, and that is a lead group in the country of scientists, physicians, nurses, other healthcare providers that act in an advisory capacity on the nation's health. The National Academy of Medicine came out yesterday with a very strong statement that we must continue to advise the nation based on the best evidence. And again, we've got to educate the public. People assume when they enter a healthcare system that they're getting the best evidence-based care. And that is not always the case. So it gets back to what Russ kept saying. People need to ask for the evidence. What's the evidence behind what you're recommending to me? Mm-hmm. What's more effective, this drug or that drug? People can't just assume they're getting the best evidence-based treatment because we know that's not always happening.
Because the answer could be, well, that's what I've always given people with your condition.
You bet.
Yeah.
Or that's the way we do it here. Or that's the way we learned it in medical or nursing school 20 years ago.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Your guest from OSU just made a very good example, maybe, of my point. The question that I had was, in the scientific end, in the terms of the medical field, there's a term, medical reversal, which refers to where nearly the entire medical establishment, practitioners or researchers, tend to strongly promote some particular policy or treatment, and years later it comes out that it's that policy or procedure or treatment has fundamentally been flawed. Two examples would be about a decade ago, the heavy push for opioid prescriptions for pain relief, and also in the 60s and 70s, hormonal contraceptives and the Dalcon shield, the ring, that at the time, anyone who questioned them was tended to be regarded as flippant, unsophisticated, unscientific, and then years later, their concerns were legitimated. So what's the role in science of policing itself? I'm very much for evidence-based, but sometimes evidence-based is used as a shield just for...
Mark, I think that's a really, really good point. The thing with the opioid thing, though, wasn't it, Dr. Melnick, that it was not evidence-based. It was a paragraph out of a journal article that somebody glommed onto, and it just became extrapolated into some kind of research that when, in there, in fact, was no research.
It is critical that science continues to evolve. It is critical that qualified groups like the United States Preventive Services Task Force, the American Heart Association, constantly is critically appraising new evidence that comes out. So again, the decisions, the policies that are formed are based on the best and strongest body of evidence that we have.
And that's why it's, you know, really important for there to be transparency with regard to how policy decisions are made and with what kind of information is made available to the public. Because, you know, a lot of the political interference in science isn't necessarily new. Whenever there's, you know, kind of money to be made, there will be someone trying to spin the information. And we've seen that in the environmental space, and we see that in the public health space. It's really important to understand the scientific basis of decisions, and that is why, you know, transparency is an essential part of that process so that people can evaluate whether or not they trust in that decision.
Michael Halpern, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
It's been great to be with you.
Michael Halpern is the Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And also, Dr. Bernadette Melnick, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Great to be here.
Bernadette Melnick is the Vice President for Health Promotion, the University Chief Wellness Officer, and Dean and Professor in the College of Nursing at Ohio State. Thanks for listening today. Appreciate your time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.